and staring at me. "Come on over," I said. "Have a drink." They declined, moving off with casual, unhurried grace, quiet as phantoms, and disappeared beyond their eyes. Smiling, thoroughly at peace, I turned back to my drink, the little fire, the subtle transformations of the immense landscape before me. On the program, Rise of the Full Moon. It was then I heard the discordant note, the snarling whine of a jeep in low range and four-wheel drive, coming from an unexpected direction, from the vicinity of the old foot-and-horse trail that leads from Balanced Rock down toward Courthouse Wash and on to park headquarters near Moab. The jeep came in sight from beyond some bluffs, turned onto the dirt road, and came up the hill toward the entrance station. Now, operating a motor vehicle on any kind of the trails of a national park is strictly forbidden, a nasty bureaucratic regulation which I heartily support. My bosom swelled with the righteous indignation of a cop. By God, I thought, I'm going to write these sons of bitches a ticket. I put down the drink and strode to the house trailer to get my badge. Long before I could find the shirt with the badge on it, however, or the ticket book, or my shoes, or my park ranger hat, the jeep turned in at my driveway and came right up to the door of the trailer. It was a gray jeep with a U.S. government decal on the side, Bureau of Public Roads, and covered with dust. Two empty water bags flapped at the bumper. Inside were three sunburned men in twill breeches and engineering boots, and a pile of equipment. Transit case, tripod, survey rod, bundles of wooden stakes. Oh, no. The men got out, dripping with dust, and the driver grinned at me, pointing to his parched open mouth and making horrible gasping noises deep in his throat. Okay, I said, come on in. It was even hotter inside the trailer than outside, but I opened the refrigerator and left it open, and took out a pitcher filled with ice cubes and water. As they passed the pitcher back and forth, I got the full and terrible story, confirming the worst of my fears. They were a survey crew, laying out a new road into the arches. And when would the road be built? Nobody knew for sure. Perhaps in a couple of years, depending on when the Park Service would be able to get the money. The new road, to be paved, of course, would cost somewhere between $500,000 and $1,000,000, depending on the bids, or more than $50,000 per linear mile. At least enough to pay the salaries of 10 park rangers for 10 years. Too much money, I suggested. They'll never go for it back in Washington. The three men thought that was pretty funny. Don't worry, they said, this road will be built. I'm worried, I said. Look, the party chief explained, you need this road. He was a pleasant-mannered, soft-spoken civil engineer with an unquestioning dedication to his work. A very dangerous man. Who needs it? I said. We get very few tourists in this park. That's why you need it, the engineer explained patiently. Look, he said, when this road is built, you'll get 10, 20, 30 times as many tourists in here as you get now. His men nodded in solemn agreement, and he stared at me intently, waiting to see what possible answer I could have to that. Have some more water, I said. I had an answer, all right, but I was saving it for later. I knew that I was dealing with a madman. As I typed these words, several years after the little episode of the gray jeep and the thirsty engineers, all that was foretold has come to pass. Arches National Monument has been developed. The master plan has been fulfilled. Where once a few adventurous people came on weekends to camp for a night or two and enjoy a taste of the primitive and remote, you will now find serpentine streams of Baroque automobiles pouring in and out, all through the spring and summer, in numbers that would have seemed fantastic when I worked there. From 3,000 to 30,000 to 300,000 per year, the visitation, as they call it, mounts ever upward. The little campgrounds where I used to putter around reading 3-day-old newspapers full of lies and watermelon seeds have now been consolidated into one master campground that looks, during the busy season, like a suburban village. Elaborate house trailers of quilted aluminum crowd upon gigantic camper trucks of fiberglass and molded plastic. Through their windows you will see the blue glow of television, and hear the studio laughter of Los Angeles. Knobby-kneed oldsters in plaid Bermudas buzz up and down the quaintly curving asphalt road on motorbikes. Quarrels break out between campsite neighbors while others gather around their burning charcoal briquettes, ground campfires no longer permitted, not enough wood, to compare electric toothbrushes. The comfort stations are there, too, all lit up with electricity, fully equipped inside, though the generator breaks down now and then and the lights go out, or the sewage backs up in the plumbing system. Drain fields are laid out in sand over a solid bed of sandstone, and the water supply sometimes fails since the 3,000-foot well can only produce about 5 gallons per minute, not always enough to meet the demand. Down at the beginning of the new road, at park headquarters, is the new entrance station and visitor center, where admission fees are collected, and where the rangers are going quietly nuts, answering the same 3 basic questions 500 times a day. 1. Where's the John? 2. How long's it take to see this place? 3. Where's the Coke machine? Progress has come at last to the Arches, after 1,000,000 years of neglect. Industrial tourism has arrived. What happened to Arches National Money Mint is, of course, an old story in the Park Service. All the famous national parks have the same problems on a far grander scale, as everyone knows, and many other problems as yet unknown to a little subordinate unit of the system in a backward part of southeastern Utah. And the same kind of development that has so transformed Arches is underway, planned, or completed in many more national parks and national monuments. I will mention only a few examples with which I am personally familiar. The newly established Canyonlands National Park. Most of the major points of interest in this park are presently accessible, over passable dirt roads, by car. Grand View Point, Upheaval Dome, part of the White Rim, Cave Spring, Squaw Spring Campground, and Elephant Hill. The more difficult places, such as Angel Arch or Druid Arch, can be reached by jeep, on horseback, or in a 1 or 2 day hike. Nevertheless, the Park Service has drawn up the usual master plan calling for modern paved highways to most of the places named, and some not named. Grand Canyon National Park. Most of the south rim of this park is now closely followed by a conventional high-speed highway, and interrupted at numerous places by large asphalt parking lots. It is no longer easy on the south rim to get away from the roar of motor traffic, except by descending into the canyon. Navajo National Monument, a small, fragile, hidden place containing 2 of the most beautiful cliff dwellings in the southwest, Keetseal and Beatatakan. This park will be difficult to protect under heavy visitation, and for years it was understood that it would be preserved in a primitive way so as to screen out those tourists unwilling to drive their cars over some 20 miles of dirt road. No longer so. The road has been paved, the campground enlarged and modernized, and the old magic destroyed. Natural Bridges National Monument, another small gem in the park system. A group of 3 adjacent natural bridges tucked away in the canyon country of southern Utah. Formerly, you could drive your car, over dirt roads, of course, to within sight of and easy walking distance, 100 yards, of the most spectacular of the 3 bridges. From there, it was only a few hours' walking time to the other 2. All 3 could easily be seen in a single day. But this was not good enough for the developers. They have now constructed a paved road into the heart of the area, between the 2 biggest bridges. Zion National Park. The northwestern part of this park, known as the Kolob area, has until recently been saved as almost virgin wilderness. But a broad highway with banked curves, deep cuts, and heavy fills that will invade this splendid region is already under construction. Capitol Reef National Monument. Grand and colorful scenery in a rugged land, south central Utah. The most beautiful portion of the park was the canyon of the Fremont River, a great place for hiking, camping, exploring. And what did the authorities do? They built a state highway through it. Lee's Ferry. Until a few years ago, a simple, quiet, primitive place on the shores of the Colorado, Lee's Ferry has now fallen under the protection of the Park Service. And who can protect it against the Park Service? Power lines now bisect the scene. A 100-foot pink water tower looms against the red cliffs. Tract-style houses are built to house the protectors. Natural campsites along the river are closed off, while all campers are now herded into an artificial steel and asphalt campground in the hottest, windiest spot in the area. Historic buildings are razed by bulldozers to save the expense of maintaining them, while at the same time hundreds of thousands of dollars are spent on an unneeded paved entrance road. And the administrators complain of vandalism. I could easily cite 10 more examples of unnecessary or destructive development for every one I've named so far. What has happened in these particular areas, which I chance to know a little and love too much, has happened, is happening, or will soon happen to the majority of our national parks and national forests, despite the illusory protection of the Wilderness Preservation Act, unless a great many citizens rear up on their hind legs and make vigorous political gestures demanding implementation of the Act. There may be some among the readers of this book, like the earnest engineer, who believe without question that any and all forms of construction and development are intrinsic goods, in the national parks as well as anywhere else, who virtually identify quantity with quality and therefore assume that the greater the quantity of traffic, the higher the value received. There are some who frankly and boldly advocate the eradication of the last remnants of wilderness and the complete subjugation of nature to the requirements of not man, but industry. This is a courageous view, admirable in its simplicity and power, and with the weight of all modern history behind it. It is also quite insane. I cannot attempt to deal with it here. There will be other readers, I hope, who share my basic assumption that wilderness is a necessary part of civilization, and that it is the primary responsibility of the national park system to preserve intact and undiminished what little still remains. Most readers, while generally sympathetic to this latter point of view, will feel, as do the administrators of the National Park Service, that although wilderness is a fine thing, certain compromises and adjustments are necessary in order to meet the ever-expanding demand for outdoor recreation. It is precisely this question which I would like to examine now. The Park Service, established by Congress in 1916, was directed not only to administer the parks, but also to provide for the enjoyment of same in such manner and by such means as will leave them unimpaired for the enjoyment of future generations. This appropriately ambiguous language, employed long before the onslaught of the automobile, has been understood in various and often opposing ways ever since. The Park Service, like any other big organization, includes factions and factions. The developers, the dominant faction, place their emphasis on the words, provide for the enjoyment. The preservers, a minority but also strong, emphasize the words, leave them unimpaired. It is apparent, then, that we cannot decide the question of development versus preservation by a simple referral to Holy Writ, or an attempt to guess the intention of the Founding Fathers. We must make up our own minds and decide for ourselves what the national parks should be, and what purpose they should serve. The first issue that appears when we get into this matter, the most important issue and perhaps the only issue, is the one called accessibility. The developers insist that the parks must be made fully accessible not only to people, but also to their machines, that is, to automobiles, motorboats, etc. The preservers argue, in principle at least, that wilderness and motors are incompatible, and that the former can best be experienced, understood, and enjoyed when the machines are left behind where they belong, on the superhighways and in the parking lots, on the reservoirs and in the marinas. What does accessibility mean? Is there any spot on earth that men have not proved accessible by the simplest means? Feet and legs and heart? Even Mount McKinley, even Everest, have been surmounted by men on foot. Some of them, incidentally, rank amateurs, to the horror and indignation of the professional mountaineers. The interior of the Grand Canyon, a fiercely hot and hostile abyss, is visited each summer by thousands and thousands of tourists of the most banal and unadventurous type, many of them on foot, self-propelled, so to speak, and the others on the backs of mules. Thousands climb each summer to the summit of Mount Whitney, highest point in the 48 United States, while multitudes of others wander on foot or on horseback through the ranges of the Sierras, the Rockies, the Big Smokies, the Cascades, and the mountains of New England. Still more hundreds and thousands float or paddle each year down the currents of the Salmon, the Snake, the Allagash, the Yampa, the Green, the Rio Grande, the Ozark, the St. Croix, and those portions of the Colorado which have not yet been destroyed by the dam builders. And most significant, these hordes of non-motorized tourists, hungry for a taste of the difficult, the original, the real, do not consist solely of people young and athletic, but also of old folks, fat folks, pale-faced office clerks who don't know a rucksack from a haversack, and even children. The one thing they all have in common is the refusal to live always like sardines in a can. They are determined to get outside of their motor cars for at least a few weeks each year. This being the case, why is the Park Service generally so anxious to accommodate that other crowd, the indolent millions born on wheels and suckled on gasoline, who expect and demand paved highways to lead them in comfort, ease, and safety into every nook and corner of the national parks? For the answer to that, we must consider the character of what I call industrial tourism and the quality of the mechanized tourists, the wheelchair explorers, who are at once the consumers, the raw material, and the victims of industrial tourism. Industrial tourism is a big business. It means money. It includes the motel and restaurant owners, the gasoline retailers, the oil corporations, the road building contractors, the heavy equipment manufacturers, the state and federal engineering agencies, and the sovereign, all-powerful automotive industry. These various interests are well organized, command more wealth than most modern nations, and are represented in Congress with a strength far greater than is justified in any constitutional or democratic sense. Modern politics is expensive. Power follows money. Through Congress, the tourism industry can bring enormous pressure to bear upon such a slender reed in the executive branch as the poor old Park Service, a pressure which is also exerted on every other possible level, local, state, regional, and through advertising and the well-established habits of a wasteful nation. When a new national park, national monument, national seashore, or whatever it may be called, is set up, the various forces of industrial tourism, on all levels, immediately expect action, meaning specifically a road-building program. Where trails or primitive dirt roads already exist, the industry expects, it hardly needs to ask, that these be developed into modern paved highways. On the local level, for example, the first thing that the superintendent of a new park can anticipate being asked when he attends his first meeting of the area's Chamber of Commerce is not, "Will roads be built?" but rather, "When does construction begin?" and "Why the delay?" The natural money mint. With supersensitive antennae, these operatives from the Sea of Sea look into red canyons and see only green, stand among flowers, snorting out the smell of money, and hear, while thunderstorms rumble over mountains, the fall of a dollar bill on motel carpeting. Accustomed to this sort of relentless pressure since its founding, it is little wonder that the Park Service, through a process of natural selection, has tended to evolve a type of administration which, far from resisting such pressure, has usually been more than willing to accommodate it, even to encourage it. Not from any peculiar moral weakness, but simply because such well-adapted administrators are themselves believers in a policy of economic development. Resource management is the current term. Old foot trails may be neglected, backcountry ranger stations left unmanned, and interpretive and protective services inadequately staffed, but the administrators know from long experience that millions for asphalt can always be found. Congress is always willing to appropriate money for more and bigger paved roads anywhere, particularly if they form loops. Loop drives are extremely popular with the petroleum industry. They bring the motorist right back to the same gas station from which he started. Great though it is, however, the power of the tourist business would not in itself be sufficient to shape Park Service policy. To all accusations of excessive development, the administrators can reply, as they will if pressed hard enough, that they are giving the public what it wants, that their primary duty is to serve the public, not preserve the wilds. Parks are for people, is the public relations slogan, which decoded means that the parks are for people in automobiles. Behind the slogan is the assumption that the majority of Americans, exactly like the managers of the tourist industry, expect and demand to see their national parks from the comfort, security, and convenience of their automobiles. Is this assumption correct? Perhaps. Does that justify the continued and increasing erosion of the parks? It does not. Which brings me to the final aspect of the problem of industrial tourism. The industrial tourists themselves. They work hard, these people. They roll up incredible mileages on their odometers, rack up state after state in 2-week transcontinental motor marathons, knock off one national park after another, take millions of square yards of photographs, and endure patiently the most prolonged discomforts, the tedious traffic jams, the awful food of park cafeterias and roadside eateries, the nocturnal search for a place to sleep or camp, the dreary routine of one-stop service, the endless lines of creeping traffic, the smell of exhaust fumes, the ever-proliferating rules and regulations, the fees and the bills and the service charges, the boiling radiator and the flat tire and the vapor lock, the surly retorts of room clerks and traffic cops, the incessant jostling of the anxious crowds, the irritation and restlessness of their children, the worry of their wives, and the long drive home at night in a stream of racing cars against the lights of another stream racing in the opposite direction, passing now and then the obscure tangle, the shattered glass, the patrolman's lurid blinker light, of one more wreck. Hard work. And risky. Too much for some who have given up the struggle on the highways in exchange for an entirely different kind of vacation. Out in the open, on their own feet, following the quiet trail through forest and mountains, bedding down at evening under the stars, when and where they feel like it, at a time when the industrial tourists are still hunting for a place to park their automobiles. Industrial tourism is a threat to the national parks, but the chief victims of the system are the motorized tourists. They are being robbed and robbing themselves. So long as they are unwilling to crawl out of their cars, they will not discover the treasures of the national parks and will never escape the stress and turmoil of those urban-suburban complexes which they had hoped, presumably, to leave behind for a while. How to pry the tourists out of their automobiles, out of their back-breaking, upholstered, mechanized wheelchairs and onto their feet, onto the strange warmth and solidity of Mother Earth again? This is the problem which the Park Service should confront directly, not evasively, and which it cannot resolve by simply submitting and conforming to the automobile habit. The automobile, which began as a transportation convenience, has become a bloody tyrant. 50,000 lives a year, and it is the responsibility of the Park Service, as well as that of everyone else concerned with preserving both wilderness and civilization, to begin a campaign of resistance. The automotive combine has almost succeeded in strangling our cities. We need not let it also destroy our national parks. It will be objected that a constantly increasing population makes resistance and conservation a hopeless battle. This is true. Unless a way is found to stabilize the nation's population, the parks cannot be saved. Or anything else worth a damn. Wilderness preservation, like 100 other good causes, will be forgotten under the overwhelming pressure of a struggle for mere survival and sanity in a completely urbanized, completely industrialized, ever more crowded environment. For my own part, I would rather take my chances in a thermonuclear war than live in such a world. Assuming, however, that population growth will be halted at a tolerable level before catastrophe does it for us, it remains permissible to talk about such things as the national parks. Having indulged myself in a number of harsh judgments upon the Park Service, the tourist industry, and the motoring public, I now feel entitled to make some constructive, practical, sensible proposals for the salvation of both parks and people. 1. No more cars in national parks. Let the people walk. Or ride horses, bicycles, mules, wild pigs, anything. But keep the automobiles and the motorcycles and all their motorized relatives out. We have agreed not to drive our automobiles into cathedrals, concert halls, art museums, legislative assemblies, private bedrooms, and the other sanctums of our culture. We should treat our national parks with the same deference, for they too are holy places. An increasingly pagan and hedonistic people, thank God, we are learning finally that the forests and mountains and desert canyons are holier than our churches. Therefore, let us behave accordingly. Consider a concrete example and what could be done with it. Yosemite Valley and Yosemite National Park. At present, a dusty milling confusion of motor vehicles and ponderous camping machinery, it could be returned to relative beauty and order by the simple expedient of requiring all visitors at the park entrance to lock up their automobiles and continue their tour on the seats of good workable bicycles supplied free of charge by the United States government. Let our people travel light and free on their bicycles. Nothing on the back but a shirt, nothing tied to the bike but a slicker in case of rain. Their bedrolls, their backpacks, their tents, their food and cooking kits will be trucked in for them, free of charge, to the campground of their choice in the valley, by the Park Service. Why not? The roads will still be there. Once in the valley, they will find the concessioners waiting, ready to supply whatever needs might have been overlooked, or to furnish rooms and meals for those who don't want to camp out. The same thing could be done at Grand Canyon or at Yellowstone or at any of our other shrines to the out-of-doors. There is no compelling reason, for example, why tourists need to drive their automobiles to the very brink of the Grand Canyon's south rim. They could walk that last mile. Better yet, the Park Service should build an enormous parking lot about 10 miles south of Grand Canyon Village and another east of Desert View. At those points, as at Yosemite, our people could emerge from their steaming shells of steel and glass and climb upon horses or bicycles for the final leg of the journey. On the rim, as at present, the hotels and restaurants will remain to serve the physical needs of the park visitors. Trips along the rim will also be made on foot, on horseback, or, utilizing the paved road which already exists, on bicycles. For those willing to go all the way from one parking lot to the other, a distance of some 60 or 70 miles, we might provide bus service back to their cars, a service which would at the same time effect a convenient exchange of bicycles and or horses between the two terminals. What about children? What about the aged and infirm? Frankly, we need waste little sympathy on these two pressure groups. Children too small to ride bicycles and too heavy to be borne on their parents' backs need only wait a few years. If they are not run over by automobiles, they will grow into a lifetime of joyous adventure, if we save the parks and leave them unimpaired for the enjoyment of future generations. The aged merit even less sympathy. After all, they had the opportunity to see the country when it was still relatively unspoiled. However, we'll stretch a point for those too old or too sickly to mount a bicycle and let them ride the shuttle buses. I can foresee complaints. The motorized tourists, reluctant to give up the old ways, will complain that they can't see enough without their automobiles to bear them swiftly, traffic permitting, through the parks. But this is nonsense. A man on foot, on horseback, or on a bicycle will see more, feel more, enjoy more in 1 mile than the motorized tourists can in 100 miles. Better to idle through one park in 2 weeks than try to race through a dozen in the same amount of time. Those who are familiar with both modes of travel know from experience that this is true. The rest have only to make the experiment to discover the same truth for themselves. They will complain of physical hardship, these sons of the pioneers. Not for long. Once they rediscover the pleasures of actually operating their own limbs and senses in a varied, spontaneous, voluntary style, they will complain instead of crawling back into a car. They may even object to returning to desk and office and that drywall box on Mossy Brook Circle. The fires of revolt may be kindled, which means hope for us all. 2. No more new roads in national parks. After banning private automobiles, the second step should be easy. Where paved roads are already in existence, they will be reserved for the bicycles and essential in-park services, such as shuttle buses, the trucking of camping gear, and concessioners' supplies. Where dirt roads already exist, they too will be reserved for non-motorized traffic. Plans for new roads can be discarded, and in their place a program of trail building begun, badly needed in some of the parks and in many of the national monuments. In mountainous areas, it may be desirable to build emergency shelters along the trails and bike roads. In desert regions, a water supply might have to be provided at certain points, wells drilled and hand pumps installed, if feasible. Once people are liberated from the confines of automobiles, there will be a greatly increased interest in hiking, exploring, and backcountry pack trips. Fortunately, the parks, by the mere elimination of motor traffic, will come to seem far bigger than they are now. There will be more room for more persons, an astonishing expansion of space. This follows from the interesting fact that a motorized vehicle, when not at rest, requires a volume of space far out of proportion to its size. To illustrate, imagine a lake approximately 10 miles long and on the average 1 mile wide. A single motorboat could easily circumnavigate the lake in an hour. 10 motorboats would begin to crowd it. 20 or 30, all in operation, would dominate the lake to the exclusion of any other form of activity. And 50 would create the hazards, confusion, and turmoil that make pleasure impossible. Suppose we banned motorboats and allowed only canoes and rowboats. We would see at once that the lake seemed 10 or perhaps 100 times bigger. The same thing holds true to an even greater degree for the automobile. Distance and space are functions of speed and time. Without expending a single dollar from the United States Treasury, we could, if we wanted to, multiply the area of our national parks 10-fold or 100-fold, simply by banning the private automobile. The next generation, all 250 million of them, would be grateful to us. 3. Put the park rangers to work. Lazy, scheming loafers, they've wasted too many years selling tickets at toll booths and sitting behind desks filling out charts and tables in the vain effort to appease the mania for statistics which torments the Washington office. Put them to work. They're supposed to be rangers. Make the bums range. Kick them out of those overheated air-conditioned offices. Yank them out of those overstuffed patrol cars and drive them out on the trails where they should be, leading the dudes over hill and dale, safely into and back out of the wilderness. It won't hurt them to work off a little office fat. It'll do them good. help take their minds off each other's wives, and give them a chance to get out of reach of the boss. A blessing for all concerned. They will be needed on the trail. Once we outlaw the motors and stop the road building and force the multitudes back on their feet, the people will need leaders. A venturesome minority will always be eager to set off on their own, and no obstacles should be placed in their path. Let them take risks, for God's sake. Let them get lost, sunburnt, stranded, drowned, eaten by bears, buried alive under avalanches. That is the right and privilege of any free American. But the rest, the majority, most of them new to the out-of-doors, will need and welcome assistance, instruction, and guidance. Many will not know how to saddle a horse, read a topographical map, follow a trail over slick rock, memorize landmarks, build a fire in rain, treat snake bite, rappel down a cliff, glissade down a glacier, read a compass, find water under sand, load a burrow, splint a broken bone, bury a body, patch a rubber boat, portage a waterfall, survive a blizzard, avoid lightning, cook a porcupine, comfort a girl during a thunderstorm, predict the weather, dodge falling rock, climb out of a box canyon, or pour piss out of a boot. Park rangers know these things, or should know them, or used to know them, and can relearn. They will be needed. In addition to this sort of practical guide service, the ranger will also be a bit of a naturalist, able to edify the party in his charge with the natural and human history of the area, in detail and in broad outline. Critics of my program will argue that it is too late for such a radical reformation of a people's approach to the out-of-doors, that the pattern is too deeply set, and that the majority of Americans would not be willing to emerge from the familiar luxury of their automobiles, even briefly, to try the little-known and problematic advantages of the bicycle, the saddle horse, and the footpath. This might be so, but how can we be sure unless we dare the experiment? I, for one, suspect that millions of our citizens, especially the young, are yearning for adventure, difficulty, challenge. They will respond with enthusiasm. What we must do, prodding the Park Service into the forefront of the demonstration, is provide these young people with the opportunity, the assistance, and the necessary encouragement. How could this most easily be done? By following the steps I have proposed, plus reducing the expenses of wilderness recreation to the minimal level. Guide service by rangers should, of course, be free to the public. Money saved by not constructing more paved highways into the parks should be sufficient to finance the cost of bicycles and horses for the entire park system. Elimination of automobile traffic would allow the Park Service to save more millions now spent on road maintenance, police work, and paperwork. Whatever the cost, however financed, the benefits for park visitors in health and happiness, virtues unknown to the statisticians, would be immeasurable. Excluding the automobile from the heart of the great cities has been seriously advocated by thoughtful observers of our urban problems. It seems to me an equally proper solution to the problems besetting our national parks. Of course, it would be a serious blow to industrial tourism, and would be bitterly resisted by those who profit from that industry. Exclusion of automobiles would also require a revolution in the thinking of Park Service officialdom, and in the assumptions of most American tourists. But such a revolution, like it or not, is precisely what is needed. The only foreseeable alternative, given the current trend of things, is the gradual destruction of our national park system. Let us therefore steal a slogan from the development fever faction in the Park Service. The parks, they say, are for people. Very well. At the main entrance to each national park and national monument, we shall erect a billboard 100 feet high, 200 feet wide, gorgeously filigreed in brilliant neon and outlined with blinker lights, exploding stars, flashing prayer wheels, and great Byzantine phallic symbols that gush like geysers every 30 seconds. You could set your watch by them. Behind the fireworks will loom the figure of Smokey the Bear, taller than a pine tree, with eyes in his head that swivel back and forth watching you, and ears that actually twitch. Push a button, and Smokey will recite, for the benefit of children and government officials who might otherwise have trouble with some of the big words, in a voice ursine, loud and clear, the message spelled out on the face of the billboard. To wit, "Howdy, folks! Welcome. This is your national park, established for the pleasure of you and all people everywhere. Park your car, jeep, truck, tank, motorbike, motorboat, jet boat, airboat, submarine, airplane, jet plane, helicopter, hovercraft, winged motorcycle, snowmobile, rocket ship, or any other conceivable type of motorized vehicle, in the world's biggest parking lot behind the comfort station immediately to your rear. Get out of your motorized vehicle, get on your horse, mule, bicycle, or feet, and come on in. Enjoy yourselves. This here park is for people. The survey chief and his two assistants did not stay very long. Letting them go in peace without debate, I fixed myself another drink, returned to the table in the backyard, and sat down to await the rising of the moon. My thoughts were on the road and the crowds that would pour upon it, as inevitably as water under pressure follows every channel which is opened to it. Man is a gregarious creature, we are told, a social being. Does that mean he is also a herd animal? I don't believe it, despite the character of modern life. The herd is for ungulates, not for men and women and their children. Are men no better than sheep or cattle, that they must live always in view of one another in order to feel a sense of safety? I can't believe it. We are preoccupied with time. If we could learn to love space as deeply as we are now obsessed with time, we might discover a new meaning in the phrase, to live like men. At what distance should good neighbors build their houses? Let it be determined by the community's mode of travel. If by foot, 4 miles. If by horseback, 8 miles. If by motor car, 24 miles. If by airplane, 96 miles. Recall the proverb, set not thy foot too often in thy neighbor's house, lest he grow weary of thee and hate thee. The sun went down, and the light mellowed over the sand and distance, and hoodoo rocks pinnacled dim in the intense inane. A few stars appeared, scattered liberally through space. The solitary owl called. Finally the moon came up, a golden globe behind the rocky fretwork of the horizon, a full and delicate moon that floated lightly as a leaf upon the dark slow current of the night. A face that watched me from the other side. The air grew cool. I put on boots and shirt, stuffed some cheese and raisins in my pocket, and went for a walk. The moon was high enough to cast a good light when I reached the place where the gray jeep had first come into view. I could see the tracks of its wheels quite plainly in the sand, and the route was well marked, not only by the tracks, but by the survey stakes planted in the ground at regular 50-foot intervals, and by streamers of plastic ribbon tied to the brush and trees. Teamwork. That's what made America what it is today. Teamwork and initiative. The survey crew had done their job. I would do mine. For about 5 miles, I followed the course of their survey back toward headquarters, and as I went, I pulled up each little wooden stake and threw it away, and cut all the bright ribbons from the bushes and hid them under a rock. A futile effort in the long run, but it made me feel good. Then I went home to the trailer, taking a shortcut over the bluffs. Rocks. The very names are lovely. Chalcedony, carnelian, jasper, chrysoprase and agate, onyx and sardonyx, cryptocrystalline quartz, quartzite, flint, chert, and sard, chrysoberyl, spodumene, garnet, zircon, and malachite, obsidian, turquoise, calcite, feldspar, hornblende, pyrope, tourmaline, porphyry, arkose, rutil. The rare metals, lithium, cobalt, beryllium, mercury, arsenic, molybdenum, titanium, and barium. And the basic rocks, basalt, granite, gneiss, limestone, sandstone, marble, slate, gabbro, shale. Most of them can be found in this area, if you look hard enough and long enough. By this area, I mean southeastern Utah, the canyon lands, Abby's country. The various forms of chalcedony, for example, are strewn liberally over the dismal clay hills along Salt Creek. Here you will find tiny crystals of garnet embedded in a matrix of mica schist, almondite or common garnet. Fragments of quartzite are everywhere, some containing pure quartz crystals. You might find a geode, a lump of sandstone the size and shape of an ostrich egg, or sometimes much larger. Slice it through with a diamond wheel, and you may find inside a glittering treasure trove of crystals. A treasure not in money, but in beauty. Although I have been told by some rock hounds that they can make a better living peddling gemstones and curious rocks than they could mining gold. In the washes are flint shards, edges scalloped with marks of secondary chipping, man-made. For the Indians were here, too, centuries ago. Trace the drainages upstream and look in shady alcoves under the canyon walls. There in the sand and dust, among the pack rat storehouses and the litter of other animals, you will find the motherlode, the place where the naked, indolent savages lounged about making jokes, pictures, and conchoidal fractures in flint. Flakes, scales, splinters of failed and incompleted points scatter the ground. If you are extremely lucky, you may discover a complete and intact arrowhead, possibly a spearhead, some of them in translucent obsidian, volcanic glass, Apache tears. Lying within the bounds of a national monument, these rocks and artifacts are protected by law. That is, you are welcome to look, to pick up and examine, but not to remove. And justly so. For without such protection, the area would soon be picked clean by souvenir hunters, acquisitive rock hounds, and the commercial merchandisers of stones. For my own part, I seldom take rocks home, no matter where I might find them. In my opinion, they are best enjoyed in situ, where God himself, so to speak, and the leisurely economy of nature have seen fit to deposit them. Petrified wood is also common in the canyon country, not so much in the vast formations of sandstone, which bulk largest in the landscape, but at odd, irregular places where clays, shales, and mudstones appear. Among the liver-colored hills along the Paria, under the orange cliffs west of the Standing Rocks, in the exquisitely carved facades that line the Fremont River, and in general in any sort of badlands or painted desert terrain. Nothing so extensive or spectacular as the deposits in Petrified Forest National Park, to be sure, but interesting and beautiful just the same. The gradual cell-by-cell replacement or infiltration of buried logs by hot silica-bearing waters in a process so exact that the original cellular structure of the wood is preserved in all its detail forms this desert jewelry, agatized rainbows in rock. Coming unexpectedly upon such a trove, a man is sometimes overcome by greed, by the mad desire to possess it all, to load his pockets, his knapsack, his truck with these hard, lustrous treasures, and somehow transport them all from the wilderness to the shop, garage, and backyard. An understandable mania. Pack rats, hoarding string, tinfoil, old shoes, and plastic spoons, suffer from the same instinct. So that over the surface of the earth, a general redistribution of all that is loose, not nailed or bolted down, takes place, hastening the processes of geology, and continents sag at the edges. Silly, perhaps, but not in the long run harmful. Nothing is really lost except that epiphenomenon known as human delight. This, too, will be replaced. Up north, in the Rhone Cliffs, are seams of low-grade coal, and throughout an area larger than many states where Utah, Colorado, and Wyoming meet, lies an immense reserve of shale oil, riches for somebody. But these are not, strictly speaking, rock forms. There are traces of gold in the Colorado River and the sunken ruins of gigantic dredges, a few lead, zinc, and silver mines scattered about. But the only rock which has so far proved to be of commercial value in the canyon country is that called carnotite. Carnotite, a greenish-yellow ore, is a complex mineral containing radon gas, vanadium, and uranium. Here was a treasure. Spurred by the exciting demands of the Cold War, the Atomic Energy Commission, soon after our technicians had shown what they could do, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, began to promote an intensive search for uranium. With known deposits in the Southwest, the search was concentrated here, attracting fortune hunters from everywhere. Some struck it rich. A professional geologist, Charles Steen, after years of patient development and hard luck frustrations, suddenly patented a mine he called, with revealing pathos, Mi Vida. Aided by a discovery bonus from the AEC, financed by the bankers of Denver and Salt Lake City, he bought heavy mining equipment and a fleet of ore trucks, hired miners and truckers, built an ore reduction mill on the banks of the Colorado, and became, after years of effort, a happy, if beleaguered, millionaire. He constructed a modest mansion on a rocky, waterless ledge overlooking Moab, invited relatives, friends, and neighbors in for one great barbecue after another, endured threats of blackmail and kidnapping, he had children, from mysterious strangers, built a garrison-type steel fence topped with barbed wire around his entire property, and employed guards and a gatekeeper, planted trees along the fence to soften the warlike aspect, ran for public office and was elected, tried to legalize hard liquor and was defeated, sold his mill to the Vanadium Corporation of America, moved elsewhere, came back, moved again. Another prospector, an amateur but equally fortunate, was Vernon Pick. Drifting in from somewhere out of the Midwest, he lost himself for weeks at a time among the haunted monoliths and goblin gulches above the Dirty Devil River. Poisoned himself drinking its foul waters, but survived to locate deep in that intricate voodoo land a smoldering radioactive hoard which he named, poetically, the Hidden Splendor. Some of the native Utahns also made money, particularly the ones shrewd enough the moment the boom took off to hustle out into the boondocks and stake claims on everything in sight. A few of these claims were developed, and some yielded a profitable tonnage of uranium ore. But most of the wealth was acquired not in mining, but in the trading and selling of claims and shares in mining companies which never got beyond the paperwork. Speculation was the big thing, and the money poured in from all over the United States from those persons, always numerous in our society, eager to profit from the labor of others, anxious to harvest what they had not sown. But here was planting, of a sort, the variety known in the industry as salting, and many investors betrayed by their greed were taken for a jolly ride. The serious prospecting was carried out by the technicians of the Atomic Energy Commission. Equipped with powerful scintillometers, they cruised in airplanes back and forth above the Colorado Plateau, mapping the hotspots. The information thus obtained was made available to the public, but usually too late. The small-time prospector, grinding in by jeep, would arrive in time to see the helicopters of some big mining company rising skyward, and the land neatly staked out in acres and acres of identical claims. Despite such unfair competition, the more persevering among the amateur prospectors, climbing over the landscape with their cheap little Geiger counters in hand, sometimes succeeded in finding a source of radiation all their own. The next step was to stake a claim and have it filed with the county recorder. But now their problems were only beginning. Before they could raise the money to finance a mining operation, it was necessary to have core samples taken in order to assay the quality and the extent of the uranium deposit. This meant, first of all, bulldozing a road into the claim. Then, if they had any money left, or could borrow more, they had to hire or lease a drilling rig. All very expensive procedures. If the drilling proved out, they might be ready to go into business, or might not, depending upon still other factors, such as the expense of trucking the ore from mine to mill. The AEC provided a guaranteed market at a guaranteed price for a period of 10 years beginning in 1949, for all of the uranium ore, at or above a specified grade, which the miners could produce, plus a discovery bonus of $10,000. But even so, it became apparent after a time that only large-scale operations, in this as in most other businesses, would make a profit. Also, the many small ore pockets scattered about the canyon country were soon made insignificant by the location of vast contiguous bodies of uranium in the Ambrosia Lake District of New Mexico and in Ontario. The small independent miners in Utah, forced to transport their ore long distances over the tire-busting, axle-breaking, clutch-burning terrain of the canyon lands, where roads run every way but straight, found themselves up against the overwhelming competition of such giants as the Anaconda Corporation, with generals and admirals on its governing board and senators on the invisible payroll. When the AEC's 10-year guarantee ran out, most of the independents went out with it, out of business. There must have been many who were glad to quit, for in addition to the unnumbered exasperations and frustrations which plagued the small businessman, and the customary hazards of work in a mine, suggestions of another danger, nuclear radiation, could not be entirely ignored. The uranium miner down deep in his burrow was not only inhaling rock dust every minute, and working daily with dynamite, his body was absorbing far more than the usual dosage of alpha, beta, and gamma rays. The miner would disregard this danger, so vague, theoretical, and intangible, to him. But for the rest of his life, whenever he became sick or his health seemed to be ebbing, he might remember and wonder about the rumors he had heard years before, in the bars and machine shops of Moab, Monticello, Mexican Hat, Green River. Those hot, dusty, strange and isolated little towns set so far apart from one another, so far from anywhere, in the middle of silence and emptiness and burning rock. Whatever the cost, there was for all who took part the zest of gambling and the exhilaration of adventure into unknown or little-known territory. For a few, an adventure which became a nightmare. Two men, for example, greenhorn treasure seekers, went down the Colorado in a small motorboat overloaded with canned goods, ore samples, hammers, Geiger counters. When they reached the junction with the Green River, something went wrong. The motor failed, and they drifted helplessly into the 40-mile mill race of Cataract Canyon, a place where they had not planned to go. Nearly a century before, Major Powell, the first man to go through and write about it, described a portion of Cataract Canyon as follows.